All right. How are y'all feeling? Everyone doing all right? Feels a little subdued in here tonight. It's all that rain the last 2 days. Is that what did it? Okay. No. Coffee didn't get here soon enough. Is that it? More caffeine. All right. Feel free to get up and caffeinate if you need to. Tonight we are in 1 Corinthians still, walking our way through that book, through the lectionary text, and we're in 1 Corinthians. And it's been funny because they've done a couple weeks in a row where they choose like 3 or 4 verses, and it's really not much stuff. And then this week it's like, oh, we'll just do a whole chapter. So this is like the entire chapter of chapter 8 in 1 Corinthians this week. And it's a scripture, when you first read it, at least when I was first reading it, seems completely irrelevant today, to us today. There's this very kind of specific situation that Paul is writing to the church in Corinthians about. Remember, we are reading a letter to someone, we're reading someone else's mail, and that can provide difficulty sometimes. This is one of those great situations where what Paul writes pretty explicitly lays out whatever the letter that he got must have had in it. Like, I mean, he kind of says, well, in regards to the thing that you said in your letter, da da da, da, you know, and then kind of, it's great. So it kind of fills in the blanks in this situation. We're not having to do too much guesswork. But it is a scenario for that church that feels very disconnected from us today. And even though it feels like it's a foreign topic, I would argue that in principle, it's very, very relevant. And I would argue that in our Christian history, lots of metaphorical and sometimes physical blood has been spilled in the violation of the principle that's at play here, even if the specifics may be a little bit different. There is something here for us. So just a little bit about the context of this teaching, so as we read it, you kind of understand what's going on. From what I can gather in the reading and studying this week, this whole text is about the idea of whether or not you should eat. On the surface, it's about whether or not you should eat meat that has been sacrificed in foreign gods' temples to other gods, right, to idols, to use the Christian term. Because, of course, the Christians of this day, the Jews in the Christians' day, believe that there is one God, right, so any other gods are false gods and they're idols. And so the Corinthians are in a very cosmopolitan place. A lot of the people that would have been a part of the Corinthian church would have spent a lot of their lives in these other religious traditions, in these other temples, sacrificing to and worshiping what they now would call idols. And so there's this weird kind of tension for those folks, and there's people that have different opinions on how you should or shouldn't handle it. And from what I could gather again at the time is that in this place, as it talks about eating meat, meat was really kind of a luxury item back then. I know we tend to think about meat's not that big a deal to us. Maybe it should be a bigger deal to us. Arguably, if you believe that's awesome. I can't accept that personally yet, just because I love bacon so much. But I'm sure maybe I'll come around someday. But back then it was a luxury item. It cost a lot. There wasn't a lot of it. And in that time and place, the majority of meat that would have been available to purchase and then eat as a family would have come to you through the temples. It would have been like some ritual sacrifices. Maybe they would do like a blood sacrifice or a, you know, sacrifice of the fat of the animal or parts of the animal, but not all of the animal. And then the stuff that was kind of left over, and this worked in Jewish circles too for their in their worship. There would be this leftover meat and some stuff the priests would get to keep in certain situations, and then other things they would then go outside of the temple or outside of whatever the kind of area was, and they would sell it. And so you have this situation where for this church in Corinth, you have people that are from different kinds of schools of thought. Now, there's probably also a little bit of a rich person, poor person thing going here, maybe. It's not explicitly written, but if it was a luxury item, you can imagine that those who didn't really have access to it would have a little easier time having stronger opinions about not having it. You know how that goes. Like, you know, if it's not an option, then you're really against it. And then it becomes an option. You're like, I mean, it's not that bad. Maybe a couple bacon bits. So you have all these kind of dynamics going on. And the essential problem here is that there were some of the people, it seems, in this church who were freely going, who had the means and were freely going out, and they were purchasing this meat and they were eating it. And the reason why they're doing it is because they're monotheists and they have the money to get it. And I mean this, there's only one God, right? So you can go ahead and sacrifice this to whatever God you think is out there. It's not a real God. There's nothing real going on there. I don't believe in that God. Therefore, this meat, there's nothing magical about this meat, right? You can say I dedicate this, you know, this cow in the name of Voldemort, but I don't believe Voldemort's real. I mean, a couple of you are a little nervous. I've said his name twice out loud, but most of us don't actually think Voldemort's real. And so it would be the same kind of thing, right? If you told me, hey, we were at Ed's last week and you said, hey, I've dedicated this burger to Voldemort. I just need you to know that. I'd be like, okay, great. Let me eat it. I don't care. That doesn't mean anything to me, right? But then you have others who maybe because they were, entrenched in this foreign, what is now foreign and idolatrous worship for a long time, and it meant something to them, and they were kind of taken out of that and brought into the Christian church and have very strong feelings and have had this new way of looking at the world, and they want nothing to do with that stuff. And to them, or maybe just because they have a different kind of theology, to them, you don't touch that stuff. You know, that's to a foreign God. That's idolatrous to even touch that stuff, right? And so you have this kind of conflict going on in the church. We have some people who feel absolutely free to partake in this and gladly do it and have a good theological reasons to do it. And the other group of people in the church who struggle with that whole idea and can't understand how a good person of faith would do something like this, so idolatrous and terrible. So it's dealing with basically a church conflict, which I know none of us can ever relate to, because none of you have ever been in a church that had a conflict like that, where people disagreed about things and fought about it. But just imagine a world where that might happen. And I don't really even know what a kind of a modern parallel would be. Certainly there's any theological issues we disagree on within any kind of church body, you could draw some parallels. When it comes to food, we don't really have, I mean, Chick-fil-A might be the closest. We somehow think it's sanctified. I don't know why the church has decided that it's holy chicken. It tastes delicious, but I don't think it's actually sanctified. But this, it's just not really, this specific kind of issue is a little different than things that we deal with here. But the way Paul addresses this and the kind of principles that undergird his answer to this are very applicable to us today. And so I want to go through that. And the first thing I want to do is just look at the first three verses, because Paul says a lot in those first three verses to kind of set the backdrop on which he's then going to make his larger point. And he says this, and again, this is one of those great little lines, you know, where we're reading someone else's mail, and he just says, "Now about food sacrificed to idols," like, that's great. Thanks for letting us in on that. Now we know what he's talking about. "Now, about food sacrificed to idols, we know that we all possess knowledge. But knowledge puffs up, while love builds up. Those who think they know something do not yet know as they ought to know. But whoever loves God is known by God." So that is a mouthful of stuff right there. Each one of those sentences has got a lot of weight to it. So I want to just take a minute and kind of go through those little four things, and then we'll talk about where he goes with it. So first thing, Paul starts off very broadly with this backdrop on what he's going to paint, and he says to start with, and I read this very sarcastically. Now this may be kind of one of those Rorschach tests where, because I'm sarcastic, I assume the Bible's being. Maybe it's not. But first off, he says, we all have knowledge, right? And I really love this as a starting point. Here's how I read it. Again, there's no special font in the Bible to indicate that it was like sarcastic or anything like that. This is just how I read it. How I read it is essentially like, oh, you know stuff? Congratulations. We all know stuff, right? Who cares? You know, you were so smart. Oh, you've got this whole theology figured out. Oh, congratulations. We all have knowledge, right? It's this idea that what is most important is he starts off by taking out the legs of anyone who's feeling really smart and superior, right? He says, we all have knowledge. And then he says this next, and here's why he's taking the legs out from whoever that person is. Next he says, knowledge puffs up, right? Oh, man, you've got knowledge. Congratulations. We all have knowledge. And he says, be careful, essentially. Knowledge puffs up. Knowledge tends to make you feel superior to those around you. Knowledge can be a real ego trip, right? Look, I'm really glad you know some stuff. Also, we all know things. Be careful, because what you know can very easily manifest itself in pride, can very easily become a point of feeling superior to other people. And I would love to say this must have been a peculiar problem just for those in the Corinthian church, but this is 100% true of me. It's 100% true of me. Typically, when I arrive at some kind of quote-unquote special knowledge, when I learn something that it feels like no one else knows, that's when I start to feel really good about myself, and I begin to survey all the unwashed masses out there. All those poor people who don't know as well as I know, who are not privy to the special information that I am now the possessor of. You know, it's a shame, really, that all of them are not as elevated as I am. And I don't think it's just me. I think we all do that, right? My first year of seminary, I grew up in church, grew up in Christian schools. I would have passed any Bible test when I was a kid. I took like 6 months of classes to become a member of my church. I knew the creeds. Like, I knew all that stuff. And I went to seminary purely because it's what you were supposed to do if you wanted to go into ministry. Because the truth was, I already knew everything. I grew up in church. I grew up in Christian schools and Sunday school classes and Bible classes. I already knew everything. Which is what seminary professors love to see come walking in the door the very first day of class. Just so you know, they won't admit it. They'll act like it's hard. They love it because they're mean a lot of times. And so I walked in knowing everything, right? And then promptly had everything I've known just get destroyed. I mean, every perfectly well thought out thing that I had to say, they had something better to come back against it. They had some way of undercutting it, some way of pulling out some logical inconsistency I had with it. Like, I had no idea how little I knew, right? And then I saw I'm getting all this just kind of smashed underneath me. And then by the end of that first year was kind of when the rebuilding had started. It was a wonderful process for me. It was a little bit painful and a little bit disorienting, but like one of the best things that's ever happened to me. But by the end of that year and going into that next year, I was starting to put pieces back together. I suddenly began to see myself as someone who had special knowledge. I mean, I knew things that other people didn't know now. All those who didn't go through that thing that I just went through, right? And I started making the same mistake I was making when I walked in the door. I just knew I was a little bit special, and I would walk in. And God's honest truth, and it's stupid to think about now, but I would walk in if I was like preaching at a church, or even if I was just sitting in the pew, I would walk in and just kind of sit there going, "Huh, it's too bad everyone else doesn't know what I know, or good thing they have me here to dispense the pure knowledge I have that they are not in possession of." Right? It breeds this in me. It breeds it every time. This special kind of knowledge, whether it's conscious or not, knowledge tends to just make me feel really good about me, right? It puffs me up. Now, I'm not pro-ignorance, personally. You might not know that by the way I practice my life, but I'm not, in philosophy, I'm not pro-ignorance. But I am also very leery of whenever I begin to notice that I think I know more than other people, or that I have some kind of special knowledge, watch out. For me personally, watch out. Something bad is coming around that corner, right? I don't think I'm the only one that does this. And I would bet if you were really honest right now, I'm not asking you to raise your hand, if you think about maybe whatever area you most disagree with other people in, maybe it's politics, or maybe it's theology, or maybe it's, whatever, sports. Whatever it is, if you're really honest, deep down inside, you know you're smarter than the people you disagree with. Don't you? Because I do. I mean, I just know I'm smarter. I mean, ultimately, hopefully they'll see the error of their ways. But deep down, I know that I know more than they do. If they only knew as much as I did, obviously they would come to the same conclusion, right? There's this kind of deep-seated arrogance that comes with it. I have it. I still have it. So basically, you know things? Great. We all know things. Be careful. Knowledge puffs up. And then third, he says love builds up. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. In other words, love is greater than knowledge. Because love builds others up, not just our own ego. And they're not incompatible. I'm not saying you have to be ignorant to be loving. But love builds up. Paul immediately reminds everyone that however incredibly smart they are, it doesn't matter if you don't love. It doesn't matter if you don't love. Your ego may be stroked by your vast knowledge, but love is greater than knowledge. Love takes out the legs from out from under your ego, and it builds up those around you. There's no doubt in the kingdom of God which one is valued more. Like, it's not a question. Love is greater than having the right answers. God isn't impressed by my knowledge. God only recognizes love. And then ultimately, finally, he says, for anyone who's kind of not picking that up, any of you who think you know something, don't yet know what you ought. That is one of the most painful sentences in the Bible to me. As soon as you think you're smart, you're not. As soon as you think you have the answers, you don't. The surest sign that someone is not really knowledgeable is when they have complete self-confidence that they know it all. And some of you just thought of a specific person in your life. Someone else may have just thought of you. I'm just saying, it's possible. Right? The psalm that you heard earlier tonight, it says, fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. And what that means is the reverence and awe of God is the soil in which true wisdom grows. The understanding that there is a God and it is not little old me. If you don't have that framework, then the rest doesn't count for much, right? A lack of humility is a sure sign of foolishness. I don't know about you, but the older I get, the less I know. I am currently already far too old to have the answers. 18-year-old me would be very disappointed in 43-year-old me. I knew way more when I was 18 than I do right now. There's no one more frustrating than someone who doesn't recognize the fact that they don't know it all. Right? We all have knowledge, which tends to make us feel pretty good about ourselves. But love is better than knowledge. Love builds other people up. And remember, you're not that smart. This is how Paul starts. Then he gets into the specifics kind of the specific issue here, but I think there's still more, I guess pun intended, meat on this bone for us. So let's keep reading. So then, about eating food sacrificed to idols, we all know that an idol is nothing at all in the world, and that there is no God but one. This comes from the Shema of Israel, right? The Lord your God is one. For even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many quote-unquote gods and many quote-unquote lords, yet for us there is but one God, the Father, from whom all things came and for whom we live. And there is but one Lord, Jesus Christ, from whom all things came and through whom we live. So right off the bat, he's kind of intellectually agreeing with the meat eaters here. Of course, it's just food. We know there's only one God. We know that these are just little g, quote-unquote, gods and little l, quote-unquote, lords. The food's not magic, right? He kind of philosophically agrees with their position. But not everyone possesses this knowledge. Some people are still so accustomed to idols that when they eat sacrificial food, they think of it as having been sacrificed to a god. And since their conscience is weak, it is defiled. But food does not bring us near to God. We are no worse if we do not eat and no better if we do. Be careful, however, that the exercise of your rights does not become a stumbling block to the weak. I think that sentence right there is a really hard one for us Americans to swallow. I'm big on my rights. No matter what it means for other people, right? For if someone with a weak conscience sees you, with all your knowledge, again, I read that very sarcastically. I don't know if that's what he's saying. I mean, with all your knowledge. Someone with a weak conscience sees you with all of your knowledge eating in an idol's temple. Won't that person be emboldened to eat what is sacrificed to idols? So this weak brother or sister for whom Christ died is destroyed by your knowledge. When you sin against them in this way and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if what I eat causes my brother or sister to fall into sin, I will never eat meat again, so that I will not cause them to fall. All the vegetarians in the room found a verse that they can proof text for the rest of their lives. While Paul might intellectually agree with the meat eaters here, as I usually do, he also carries out the principle of love being greater than knowledge. So he carries out these principles he laid out in the beginning. There are better and more beautiful things than being right. There are better and more beautiful things than being right. We should be a people who are chiefly concerned with being kind, not correct. We should be a people who are chiefly concerned with being kind rather than being correct. Sounds easy enough, right? This is an eternally difficult thing for me to embody and live out. I'd much rather be correct than kind. I like being right. In our first arguments as a married couple, I was completely unaware of this truth, and I could probably get an amen from Sarah on that. I came from a family that talks a lot about a lot of things. Everything's kind of on the table in my family. We just talk through everything, and we just like to hear ourselves talk about these things. And I have a dad who thoroughly enjoyed playing devil's advocate for everything. Drove my sister crazy, and I loved it. I engaged it constantly. So I could say something that I knew my dad actually believed or agreed with, and he would challenge me on it, even though I knew he agreed with me, just because he would make me defend what I said, right? And so I couldn't get away with any of that kind of stuff. He just constantly, well, why would you say that? Well, what about this? And he just did that. He got some kind of sick joy out of it, and I liked it too. It's a very symbiotic relationship between the two of us. So Dad would always challenge my assumptions. I liked that back and forth. I didn't take it personally. It didn't feel like anything emotional to me. It was just purely kind of, you know, just engaging at a level and trying to prove I was right. And it was this kind of sport. So early in our marriage, when I was 100% right about something and Sarah would, for some mystifying reason, not understand how right I was, we would begin to argue about it or have a conversation. What's the most pastoral word for that? We'd argue about it. We just argue about something, right? And I wouldn't let it go until she agreed with my correct position. And it wouldn't, I mean, we never yelled at each other. It was never like, no one ever said, you know, called each other names or anything. It wasn't like anything aggressively demeaning. Intentionally demeaning. But until Sarah saw the truth of my ways, until she agreed with my opinion, I'm sorry, fact, I wouldn't let it go. I would want to keep it going, keep that volley going until she saw how brilliant I was. And this did not go well, as it turned out. And Sarah comes from a very different family. They didn't talk about much, and so there wasn't a whole lot of that going on. It felt personal to her really early and often, even when I didn't intend it to. And eventually, though, because she did not like that back and forth and didn't like the way that whole thing felt, and eventually she would relent. And so I would quote-unquote win in my mind, right? Except that the woman I pledged my life to and I loved more than anyone else would go away feeling devalued or ignored or whatever. And so as it turned out, my wins would feel a whole lot more like everybody in the world lost. And I did not know how to I couldn't figure that out. How was it that we both came to the realization of how smart I am, and yet it doesn't feel good? right? This should feel good. It took me a while, and it took some honest conversations between us for me to realize that, one, I'm not that smart, but more important than that, I was far too in love with trying to be correct. I wanted to be right. I wanted to be correct more than I wanted to be kind. And what I now know and hopefully practice, and I hope to practice with my daughter and my friends, is that there may be disagreements, and that's fine, and it's okay to have an opinion. It's okay to voice that opinion, but at the end of the day, if I'm not first and foremost kind, then it doesn't matter how correct I am. I've missed it. So what I want to close with tonight is to think about this. Which do you prefer, let's be honest, which do you prefer, being correct or being kind? Do you like being right or do you like being loving? I would argue this is part of what's so destructive potentially about social media, right? You ever wonder why so many conversations get so off the rails so quick? I mean, every once, and I'll be honest, I absolutely know what I'm doing. About every 2 months, I decide just to poke the social media bear. I don't know why I'm having one of those days. I'm just up for the fight. And there'll be something that happens, and I do have strong feelings about it, and I know I'm right about it. And I know a lot of my friends who come from very different places than me are gonna hate it. And so I boldly put it up there because I'm definitely gonna convince them I'm right. So I poked the bear, 348 comments and 17 hours later. It doesn't feel like anything good has happened. And why is that? And I never thought about it through this lens until this week when I was thinking about this whole thing and trying to apply it to my life. And I realized it's really difficult to focus on kindness from behind a keyboard and a screen. I'm not saying you can't be kind on social media, but it doesn't lend itself towards it very much. It is made for those of us who like to be correct. I mean, it is just gasoline on that fire. It's a lot of puffed up knowledge getting volleyed back and forth, right? I should say knowledge when it comes to Facebook, right? Social media is a great platform for puffing myself up and for deflating others down, which means more puff for me. But it's generally a pretty terrible platform for genuine kindness. Now, I'm not saying social media is necessarily the cause of the problem, or maybe it's a fruit of it, or just shows us what's true about ourselves. I don't know. But I know it works against the very principles here that I feel like Paul is telling us. Do we value being kind or correct? I'd argue one of the reasons that the Christian faith has become less and less relevant and desirable to anyone is because we've answered that question incorrectly. I know my church growing up, we put a much higher value on being correct than we did on being kind. So let's close with this truth tonight. Paul teaches us here that we should always, always choose to be kind over being correct. Always. This by itself, if truly embodied, would make us a very peculiar people in the world. Got to spend some time in the last week. It's cloud nine for me. Some of you may be like, if I could just spend time, you know, with my favorite athlete or my favorite intellectual. I found out about a week and a half ago that we've got real life, authentic Lancaster, Pennsylvania Mennonites in our town right now. They've been doing tornado relief work here for months, and I didn't know it. Like the foundation that I'm a part of and other groups have been paying for supplies, and the Mennonites are just showing up, rotating out every 1 or 2 weeks, and just doing all the work for free. And I don't mean like the kind of work that you and I have done on youth trips sometimes, where you're like, that roof's not going to last more than 2 months. But praise Jesus. I mean, like, legit, like, they all, everyone knows what they're doing, right? And I am completely enamored with the Mennonites. Like, I read about their history and I read their theologians, and like, it's my dream to get to spend a bunch of time with Mennonites and just learn from it. Genuinely, like, I consider myself a secret Mennonite. I don't have a strong enough beard game. I know that, and I'm not nearly handy enough. And I don't think I could do the haircuts they're doing. But genuinely, I believe they have it right. Like, I'm just utterly convinced of it. And as I've been talking with them, I've been trying to find out if there's anyone that's a part of this group that would feel comfortable with or feel remotely qualified to come here and talk to us. Because I want people to understand, I really want y'all to understand kind of where they come from and why they do what they do and why they, because I think it's just beautiful. And I'm having a really hard time finding anyone doing it. And the reason is because they genuinely, this is part of their DNA now, they don't think they know anything special. They don't want to be recognized. I don't mean like from a distance. They're very recognizable in that sense. I mean, like, when the news cameras came for the last house dedication we did for the 90-year-old woman who just got her house back here in this neighborhood, and they built the entire thing, they were in there, they wanted to sing a hymn, they gave her a Bible, but the TV cameras came out, and I end up on there flapping my gums, and this is literally the first moment I've ever set foot in that house, like I had something to do with it. They're all like, they part the Red Seas. And they're not Amish, they don't have that thing where you can't film me, they're not trying to get attention for themselves. He said, we don't believe in trying to convince people to be Mennonite. We believe in being kind to people and just letting that speak for itself, right? No, I mean, it was almost disarming to be around someone who felt no need whatsoever to be correct in my eyes. They didn't feel an ounce of need in them to say, well, you know why we dress like this, and you know why we're doing it. Like, they didn't. There's no defense needed. All they cared about was being kind to people they don't know at all. And they are weird to us, right? I mean, they are peculiar. If you're driving down the street and you see that van load of Mennonites come by, you're gonna do a double take. If you see them walking around and you see the way they're behaving, you're going to do it. They stick out like a sore thumb. And I think this is one of the primary reasons why, because they have this right. I think we have a lot to learn from them. So may we take the words of Paul here to heart. We all know stuff, so don't get cocky. Be careful, because your knowledge can make you feel like you are something you are not. And if you begin to think like you know something, that's your first sign you don't know anything yet. Being correct doesn't matter in and of itself. Being kind is all that matters eternally. And love is always the measure. Love is the only thing that matters. Let's pray.